Microsoft's Threat Intelligence Center, something known as MYSTIC, is seeing some new worrying signs on the Russian-Ukrainian cyber front. In a new report, they said they believe Sandworm, a cyber military unit of Russia's intelligence service, has been launching new phishing campaigns against defense companies and the energy sector in Ukraine. And they're seeing fresh cyber espionage operations and stepped-up coordination with hacktivist groups. But perhaps the biggest surprise of the cyber war against Ukraine thus far is that there hasn't been more of it. More attacks on networks, more crippling malware, all of which had us bracing for an impact that never really materialized. I joined Jen White, the host of WAMU's 1A, recently to talk about the lessons learned so far from the world's first true hybrid war. Belgian journalist Brecht Castel was also part of the discussion. And among other things, we talk about what we're likely to see next as Russia's aggression in Ukraine enters its second year.
Joining us from Utah is Dina Temple-Raston. She's the host and executive producer of Click Here. That's a weekly cyber and intelligence news podcast. Dina, it's great to have you back.
Thank you very much.
So you and other intelligence experts call Russia's war against Ukraine the world's first true hybrid war. What do you mean?
Well, one way to think about it is that cyber warfare had previously been sort of a tool instead of a strategy. And now it's completely folded into the campaign itself, seamlessly. So late last year, we did a story about a huge energy company in Ukraine called Naftogaz. It's the country's largest state oil and natural gas company. And Russia had been trying, with mixed results, to hack into them for years, and for obvious reasons, because it would let them turn out the lights. So just before the war, Naftogaz calls in Microsoft and another U.S. cyber company called Mandiant, and they ask them to fortify their network perimeter, you know, to make the walls around their computer system stronger. And they do. And then the war starts, and all this malware comes in, and it keeps reappearing in their systems. And these passwords and logins continue to be stolen. And they start to think, oh, no, we've got an insider threat. We have Russians inside, you know, Naftogaz. And it turns out that they hadn't accounted for occupying Russian troops folding cyber into their plan. So as the Russians were going into the eastern part of Ukraine, they were occupying critical facilities in Ukraine's infrastructure, you know, like telecoms and energy. And then they were plugging their computers into their networks from the inside. So they had computer geeks that were actually embedded with their occupying forces. And they'd physically capture a data center, and then the computer geeks would plug in their systems. And then they were also like grabbing computers from people as they were invading. So a Ukrainian employee from Naftogaz would have to hand over their computer, and all of a sudden they were then in the system. So how did Naftogaz fix this? The way they fixed it is by changing their mindset and thinking about cyber as being part of a broader war. So they actually had employees call their managers and say, okay, the Russians are coming into town now. And they would shut down that part of the network. So that's what they mean by you know, hybrid war.
Dina, you explained sort of the physicality, I guess I would call it, of how the technology has changed. But how else are cyber tools being used on both sides of this conflict in ways that are new?
I think that just sort of the sheer volume is new. There was a big report that came out from the Ukrainian, they have like a CISA like ours, and they said that they've had over 1,000 critical and really high level attacks just in the past year. And that's a lot, right? So that's part of it. And then there's something called a wiper malware. And this is a new thing that's come out that we haven't seen as much of. Wiper malware, just to explain what it is, basically think of it as a malware that comes in and wipes your entire computer, wipes your hard drive. And it was around a little bit, but the kind of use of wiper malware that we're seeing now, we've never seen before. And when you talk about bleed over, one of the concerns is that wiper malware now becomes the norm as opposed to something that you're just using during war.
A year ago, when Russia invaded Ukraine, cybersecurity analysts and Ukrainian military officials expected a Russian cyber attack that would cripple their systems. But it never came, or at least it wasn't successful. What happened?
Well, there are three theories. The first theory is, round about December, before Christmas, a team from U.S. Cybercom, they went to Ukraine and tried to help them protect their systems. And there's a sense that they probably found a lot of things that the Russians had sort of dropped on Ukrainian systems in anticipation of the invasion, and they very quietly pulled those things away. The second theory is that, in fact, Russia was so sure that it was going to take 3 days to get to Kyiv and depose President Zelensky that they didn't want to shut things down ahead of time or shut things down in a way that would turn the people against them, since they had to win the people over once that they had toppled Zelensky. And then the third theory is that we've given the Russians a lot of credit for being amazing hackers. And one of the things that we've definitely learned is that Russians are really good at planning cyber attacks long term, but they're not super creative in turning on a dime. And one of the things that the US forces are known for is this sort of evil genius creativity of doing things that people aren't expecting. They're not seeing that from the Russians.
That leads us to this email we got from Thomas, who says, it seems that from time to time, the Russians run out of high-tech weapons and the combat tactics revert to the trench warfare of the past world wars. I wonder how much damage is being caused with cyber weapons versus the destruction done by conventional artillery. What can you tell us, Dina?
Well, I think right now, I think just about everybody can see where the big damage is coming. It's their drone attacks and it's the kinetic stuff that they're doing now. The concern was that cyber was going to do that, right? That hasn't happened. And what's also very interesting about cyber attacks is that in a way they're not as pinpointed. So if you hit a network and that network is connected to, say, Germany, all of a sudden you have gotten a NATO ally as part of the conflict.
Well, Dean, I'm also curious to hear, in this new age of the hybrid war, if a Russian attack, for instance, a Russian cyber attack affects a NATO allied nation, what does that mean? How do NATO allies react, even if it was not a direct attack, but just spillover from an attack against Ukraine?
Well, actually, that's already happened in a small way. There was a Viasat, which is how the Ukrainian military talks to each other, one of the ways that they were talking to each other. The Russians took that down. That was hacked, and it went down for a while. And of course, it was the way people in Europe were actually using the internet as well. So there was that spillover. Because cybers, it sounds like it would be a precise weapon, but it's not. You don't always know exactly who's connected to what network. So you attack a network that, say, you know, a bunch of energy companies from Ukraine is on, and you would attack their servers, and you don't even know that you're going to have bleed over maybe across the border in Poland. It's almost the same as, you know, these missiles that go, right? They're really worried that the missiles are going to cross the border. Well, it's even more likely that that can happen with a cyber attack, which is why they've been so circumspect, I think.
I want to bring another voice to the discussion. Brecht Castel is a journalist and fact checker at NAC. That's a Belgian weekly news magazine. He joins us from Brussels. Brecht, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your work as a fact checker at NAC helps debunk claims that gain traction online. In January, you debunked a story claiming that U.S. Army tanks were headed to Ukraine. How did you go about disproving that?
Well, what we do is we use OSINT. So it is open source intelligence. It's a very rich word to say. We watch a lot of clips online and try to compare them. We just gather a lot of information which is publicly available. In this case, it was people just filming with their smartphone trains passing by with tanks on them. And people thought, okay, we have heard something about a deal between Biden sending tanks and military equipment to Ukraine. So probably these are these tanks, right? But this happened so quickly after that we were like, this is not possible. This has just been made public. It's not possible that these tanks are already going to Ukraine right now. So what did we do? We geolocated a lot of these videos. So we looked like, okay, where is this filmed? Where is this train heading? We put them all on a map. And apparently they were not going to Ukraine. They were going to Lithuania, more to the north of Europe, to the Baltic countries. And it was just a NATO troop movement, so to say. So by looking into these videos and comparing a lot of them, we can find out the truth about a claim or a video. And that's what we do.
But Brecht, even in the process of debunking that claim, it is so hard to rewrite a narrative or correct disinformation once it's spread online, unless someone's actively looking for that information. So once you've fact-checked a story like that, how do you try to get it to reach as many people as possible?
That's a good question. We have someone at Kneck who really tries to bring the fact checks we do to people who are doubting about this. So if you're on Twitter and you're saying like these tanks are going to Ukraine, then she will reach out to this person to talk to him and say like, oh, maybe you should read this article because it's not entirely true. So that's the way we try to do this. For me, it's sometimes feels like a game of whack-a-mole, right? It's like you try to debunk one story and three other stories have popped up. That's true, and that's sometimes discouraging, but I try to learn people how they can do this themselves. Sometimes it's not so difficult. Sometimes just a really quick reverse image search to find where the picture is coming from. And you know, it's not the case. So by writing these stories, by telling them, by explaining them on Twitter, we learn you and me and everyone who's listening to do these kind of things themselves. And that's, I think, is the power of OSINT, of this kind of investigation, that it's not so difficult. And a lot of people are doing it professionally, like me. A lot of people are fact-checking as professional journalists, but also like a lot of volunteers are joining in this effort, and that's great.
Well, Brecht, how does the spread of disinformation affect the public's perception of the war?
Yeah, that's hard for me to like really give an overview on. But of course, it changed narratives, and another thing is that it's erodes trust, I would say, in mainstream media, for example, because you see so much things popping up, and you don't know what's true, what's not true. So you start doubting everything, and that's of course very bad for democracy, because if we cannot agree on what are the facts, what's true and what's not, it's difficult to have a debate about these facts.
Dina, how are we seeing the United States, which has grappled with its own mis- and disinformation issues, trying to push back on some of these narratives that pop up online?
It's been really remarkable what they've been doing. The Biden administration has decided to declassify intelligence. Early in the war, they gathered intelligence that seemed to indicate that the Russians were going to film a video. They were going to dress up Russians and make them look like Ukrainian soldiers and then sort of stage a massacre, film it, and then put it out as, see, this is why we're going in. This is why we have to invade. They're killing our people in the Donbas or something like that. And so what happened is before they had a chance to actually release that movie and maybe even film it, the U.S. had the intel. They declassified it and then made it public, which made it impossible for the Russians to actually put out the movie because it had been preempted. They did something similar also with China when we're hearing now about China possibly providing some sort of lethal aid to Ukraine. Well, they got this through an intelligence intercept and they released it. So it puts pressure on China to decide whether or not to do this. This is all really new because they usually keep this kind of intel really close to the vest and say, hey, just trust us. And I think in this age of misinformation, they realize that just trust us doesn't work.
After the break, more of our conversation with Jen White on WAMU's 1A. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Adam Fleming from the Global Story podcast from the BBC World Service. We are looking at Lina Khan, the face of the US government's battle to regulate big tech. She's already redefined the way we talk about monopolies. Now she's taking on the likes of Amazon and Meta. But who is she? And will she win? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Blockchain, NFTs, AI. What does this mean for you and me? I'm Sherelle Dorsey, host of the TED Tech Podcast, where we bring you the latest innovations and biggest ideas in tech. Tech is evolving fast and it affects our lives, from the metaverse to the watches on our wrists. You'll learn why people in AI make good business partners, about our future self-driving robo-taxi, what the next generation of Siri, Alexa, Google looks like, and a lot more. Find TED Tech on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Hey, it's Dina, and you're listening to Click Here. Earlier this month, I spoke with Jen White, host of WAM News 1A, about what we've learned about cyber warfare in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, back to that conversation.
Well, for your podcast, click here. You spoke with Viktor Zhora. He's a Ukrainian official in charge of defending the country's computer networks and infrastructure. Let's take a listen.
Ukraine witnessed the most destructive cyber attacks in history over the last 8 years. I suppose we were well prepared for this cyber war. So our army tries to stop the aggression on the land, and our IT army is doing the same in the cyberspace.
Now we hear Viktor there mention a Ukrainian IT army. And not long after the war began, your team spoke with Yanni. He's a member of the IT army living in Finland, and he talked about why and how he joined.
Basically, once I started hearing about civilians and children and women and elderly getting bombed or killed or starved is when I basically decided that I have to do something.
What was the sign-up process like, or was there one?
There wasn't any. That's one of the big problems here, actually. Basically, anybody can join in and start doing whatever.
Dina, what more did you learn about this Ukrainian IT army and how it's fighting back?
There are essentially two Ukrainian IT armies, right? There's one that's connected to the military, and that's the sort of more traditional one. But what they did at the beginning of the war is they asked for volunteers, basically think of it as IT professionals, cybersecurity professionals around the world to come and help them. Yanni, he's one of the administrators of the IT army. And when he says there was no sign up, it was basically everybody sort of gets into a chat room and says, okay, what do we do? And one of the things that they were doing early on was DDoS attacks. These are basically attacks where you flood a network with so much traffic that it basically goes down, right? And they're super basic. But one of the problems with this was because there is no real coordination, it's just all these volunteers across different time zones. Yanni was telling us that they have some of their higher level hackers, and they'd be hacking this, and then all of a sudden it would be taken down by a DDoS attack by some of these sort of IT army folks who maybe weren't as skilled. So there's a term in cyber, it's called script kiddies. And it basically means that you can't really code very well and you kind of fake it and use other people's code and pass it off as your own. So a lot of script kiddies joined the IT volunteer army, as well as a lot of people who really know what they're doing, people who are cybersecurity professionals. And the concern is that you're getting all these people who are getting new cyber skills because they're part of the Ukrainian IT army, and almost like mercenaries who go and fight, you know, like when they fought in the Spanish Civil War, they go and fight, they've stopped, and then they have nothing to do. And so what do they do instead? They find somewhere else to do this. And so what we're doing is we're kind of training a global contingent of hackers, people who might not be that good at hacking, get all these skills, and then when this is over, what are they going to do with that? Are we creating a whole sort of generation of hacking mercenaries? That's my concern about the IT army.
We're also hearing from you. Kawi writes, no one should be surprised that cyber attacks are part of war strategy. This has been going on for at least 20 years, and now the capabilities are accessible to all countries, not just the global superpowers. It's not the first or the last time this will happen. Kawi, thanks for that message. Dina, I'd love to hear your response to that.
Yeah, I think that there's actually been a cyber component that we've been watching pretty intently since 2014, when the Russians first went into Crimea and other areas of Ukraine. I think what's different is that we always saw cyber as sort of an add-on or something that you put on top. And I don't think that's the case anymore. I think that they're really starting to be of a piece, and that when you think about a strategy or a battle plan, you're no longer thinking about here's kinetic and then we'll put cyber on top, but you're thinking, how is cyber going to help the more conventional forces going forward?
Well, at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington back in October, you spoke about the threat of Russian cyber attacks with Jen Easterly. She's the director of the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency.
We are not at a place where we should be putting our shields down. The environment is very difficult. The Russians are very unpredictable. Their back is up against the wall. We've seen these horrific kinetic attacks against civilian infrastructure. And we may be seeing a lot worse coming.
What's the most concerning cyber activity we're seeing out of Russia right now, Dina?
I think the wiper malware that we discussed before, where it actually wipes a hard drive and then starts destroying things in the network, is one of the more concerning things we're seeing. But I think a lot of listeners may not realize that there's a lot of stuff going on the fringes of the war, right? The Russians are in our networks, we think, and they're always probing to see how they can get into those networks. And by that, I mean infrastructure networks like power plants and water treatment, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, the U.S. is in theirs, too. And this is the way they're trying to keep in equilibrium. But I think that the writer or caller is right, that in fact, cyber has been around for a really long time. But the way it's being utilized is really changing.
What more can the U.S. do at this point to monitor Russian cyber threats?
Internally or in Ukraine? Or both?
Both.
I think there's an education now that is happening with the war in Ukraine that you understand that you need to be much more careful about everything you do. Everything is connected now. And now you can break into, for example, they talk a lot about supply chain. Well, it works also in cyber, right? You could break into a, you know, substation of an electrical power grid, and you break into that substation, and that gives you access to the entire network. So everybody has to be careful. It's not just the big NAFTA gas company. It's not just PG&E. It has to be everybody who possibly has a connection to them. You know, the big hack that got everybody thinking about hacking was Target years and years ago. You remember?
Yeah.
And the way that the hackers got into Target and stole all those credit card numbers was by actually getting in through a supplier who did their air conditioning. So I think that what needs to be understood is that everybody is a weak link now because of the way things are connected. And so it's not somebody else's problem anymore. It's all of our problems.
Russia is expected to launch a new offensive, specifically targeting Ukraine's Donbas region in the east. How is the Kremlin expected to use cyber criminals to aid the military effort there?
So Russia has the greatest contingent of cyber criminals in the world. Most of the ransomware attacks that you see are actually traced back to Russia. And so what's happening is that Russia is basically saying to cyber criminals, hey, we need your help. And we're not going to arrest you, even though we know you're stealing cryptocurrency, even though we know you're taking hospitals for ransom and locking up their networks. Instead of giving you a bad time about that, do us a favor, do this. And now they're adding to the war effort. There's always been a sort of grayness to how much Moscow was ever going to crack down on these ransomware criminals, but now they're using them as part of their offensive. And I think we're going to see more and more of that.
And Dina, in terms of how the U.S. moves forward in this area, what are you watching for there?
I think we're going to see more from Cybercom and NSA in discussing what it is that they're doing as part of the war effort, how their hunt teams are working towards this, what they're learning about Russian hacking. I think we'll get more education in that respect. And obviously, that's something that we're chasing a lot.
That's Dina Temple-Raston. She's the host and executive producer of Click Here, a weekly cyber and intelligence news podcast. Dina, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
A special thanks this week to WAMU's 1A, its host Jen White, and producer Lauren Hamilton. Click Here is a production of Recorded Future News. I'm Dina Temple-Raston, the executive producer and host of the show. Sean Powers is our senior producer and marketing director, and Will Jarvis is our producer. Gabriella Glick is our intern. The show is edited by Karen Duffin and Lou Olkowski, with fact-checking by Darren Ankrum. Our theme music and original compositions in the episode are by Ben Levingston, and we also use music from Blue Dot Sessions. And we want to hear from you, so please leave us a review and rating wherever you get your podcasts, or send us an email at clickhere@recordedfuture.com, and check out our website, clickhereshow.com. That's it for this week. I'm Dina Temple-Raston, and we'll be back on Tuesday.
Looking for more of the cybersecurity and intelligence coverage you get on Click Here? Then check out our sister publication, The Record, from Recorded Future News. You'll get breaking cyber news from reporters in New York, Washington, London, and Kyiv, among others. And you'll see for yourself why it attracts hundreds of thousands of page views every month. Just go to therecord.media.